dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people bring as much intelligence to bear on a particularly important facet of the war for the free world at the moment, namely the Chinese Communist Party, than does our first guest. His name is Gordon Chang. He is, I'm very pleased to say, one of our featured guests here each week, and one of our great authorities in this country on matters involving China and its ambitions under the leadership of Xi Jinping, the Chinese Communist Party's General Secretary and the dictator of China. Gordon is an author. He is an essayist. He is a, well, I think, national treasure, among other things. And I commend to you his book, among others, The Coming Collapse of China, his writings at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute, and of course, urge you to follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, the Deputy Secretary of State, a woman who has served her country in a variety of capacities, I think often to be found wanting, frankly. She was off to China over the weekend, and I gather got a rather bad time of it, and you have some insights into the larger context into which she plunged herself and the response that she got from her Chinese hosts. Tell us about it.
Well, Wendy Sherman, the Deputy Secretary of State, just wrapped up her meeting with the Chinese officials in Tianjin, which is the provincial level city next to Beijing. She met with Foreign Minister Wang Yi, and she's also met with a number of others. This was not an attempt by China to work with the United States. It was really, I think, an excuse to launch another propaganda campaign against not only Washington, but the world. And this brings to mind what happened in the middle of March in Anchorage when China's top two diplomats, Wang Yi and his boss, Yang Jiaxi, met with Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. After that, there was a concerted campaign to attack the U.S. Much of it was race-based propaganda. What we're seeing this time is another propaganda campaign launched even before the people Sherman met the Vice Foreign Minister Xi Feng. So really what we've got right now is a Beijing determined to intimidate the United States, to humiliate us, really not to have relations with the U.S., but to dictate the terms going forward. And so right now I believe that we should not be meeting with the Chinese. This comes at a time when the Communist Party is engaging in a campaign against foreigners, actually trying to stir up hate. And it comes at a time when there are so many internal problems inside China. We've got to be extremely concerned, Frank, about the direction where Beijing is going.
Give us a quick appreciation, Gordon, of some of those internal challenges.
Evergrande, which is the big real estate company in southern China, is going through a debt crisis. Many people have always said that the debt crisis will be determined by what happens to Evergrande. We've seen this concerted attack on the tech sector that led to stock market turbulence. Last night, the CSI 300, which many people use as a measure of the direction of the Chinese market, fell 3.2%. In Hong Kong, it fell by 4.2%, really a very important indicator of where things are going. We seem to have another wave of COVID inside China. There's the flood crisis, which is unimaginable, which is not just an act of nature, but really a failure of water management policies on the part of China. This is just one thing right after another. It's all occurring at the same time. These are challenges, and these are immediate challenges that I don't know if the Communist Party can meet. So we've got to be extremely concerned what Beijing's next move will be. And it could very well be lashing out as a desperate China does anything possible to attack the world.
This is the piece that we've touched on periodically in the past, Gordon, the sort of social engineering to divert attention from the shortcomings of the regime, to try to whip up nationalist fervor and find in external activities, even perhaps conflicts, some relief from the perception that perhaps the regime is losing the so-called mandate of heaven that has in the past brought about the fall of various dynasties. When you look at what's afoot here, Gordon, at the moment, and the further turbulence that the government of China is injecting into the capital markets by some of these kinds of attacks on the tech sector and the uncertainties that it is giving. You've written about these variable interest entities that are now under siege as well. Does it suggest that the Chinese are exhibiting an indifference to the sentiments of foreign investors to the point where they're prepared to see them moving out of Chinese markets in a big way?
Yeah, the Communist Party right now is engaged in an attack on its own tech sector. And this is going after some of the most productive, some of the most efficient companies, not just in China, but in the world. And we see this in a number of different ways, not only with the headlines recently, but also of the digital currency, which really is an attempt, not so much, I think, to attack the US dollar, although they'd love to do that, but it's really to attack the electronic payment platforms in China run by Ant Group and Tencent. This is part, I think, of what you just mentioned, which is eventually they're going to go after the foreign interests. Foreigners have invested in China's tech sector, which is off limits to foreign investment. And they've done that through a stratagem called these variable interest entity structures, which have been used to float stock on foreign exchanges. So, if, for instance, Alibaba, DD Global, just end of June. And really, China would be in a position to expropriate the interests of foreigners in these companies, just applying Chinese law. And we have seen China do this before. They did it with China Unicom in the 1990s, with a structure which was very similar to the variable interest entity. So we can't take for granted that China will do anything at this point. Or maybe I should put it, we can't take for granted that that certain things are now off limits to them, because I think they can really go and surprise us, not only in the tech sector, not only in stocks, but everything else.
Well, Gordon, this program and our Committee on the Present Danger of China and you and others have been warning now for some time about the mistake of investing in Chinese corporations, placing big bets with American investors' monies, as Wall Street has been doing. And this would seem to be now more and more palpable. I hope that it will result in a mass migration out of these markets, which have the effect of propping up the Chinese Communist Party and enabling some of its most malevolent behavior. Speaking of which, our colleague Steve Mosier has apparently written in a forthcoming book about a substantial expansion of a program that you've been warning about now for some time, Gordon, namely the illegal and covert biological warfare program of the Chinese Communist Party. It's now, I think, increasingly recognized that that program produced the COVID-19 virus. There's a growing body of sentiment, which I happen to share, that it was probably released deliberately rather than accidentally. But what are the implications, Gordon, of a number of additional so-called P4 laboratories being built by the Chinese in the midst of what we've learned about their aggressive pursuit of not just biological weapons, but perhaps some tailored for the purpose of wiping out certain ethnicities?
Chinese military researchers have written publicly for a decade about specific ethnic genetic attacks. In other words, developing pathogens that will leave Chinese people immune, but will sicken and kill everybody else. These are civilization killers, our civilization. So we've got to look at every single development here. China is building more P4 labs. These are the highest biosafety levels. This is where the most dangerous work occurs. And one of them was at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And we've got to remember that China has this doctrine of civil military fusion, which means that everything that is nominally civilian really is military or is available to the military, which means that all of this is really an expansion of China's biological weapons program, which is prohibited under the Biological Weapons Convention to which China ratified. So one other point here, and that is all of this was brought home, this civil-military fusion, in January of last year when Major General Chen Wei was assigned to head the P4 or BSL-4 facility at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. She is described as China's top biological weapons expert, and this made it clear that this program, not only in Wuhan but elsewhere, is run by the military. You don't send someone with stars to run a nominally civilian facility unless it really is military.
So will the others that they're building, and the prospect of a vast ramp-up in the capabilities to engage in that kind of biological warfare, whether ethnically targeted or otherwise, has to be, you know, very, very much on our minds and require responses, it seems to me, as well. Gordon, let me turn to one other topic that I found both heartening and hopefully a straw in the wind for things to come in the way of course corrections in our country. There is a new poll out from the Trafalgar Group, which is after that's developed a pretty impressive reputation for accuracy in assessing public opinion, to the effect that something on the order of 81% of those polled expressed concern about Chinese influence on our government, in our media, and in our culture more generally, with an actual majority of that sample of 1,000 or so likely voters in the 2022 elections saying that they're very concerned about what China's up to in this regard. Were you surprised by those results? And what do you think should be the takeaway for, well, for starters, the Biden administration about that popular sentiment?
I'm not surprised by the sentiment. The American people are smart. We got to be extremely concerned that that view is not shared by America's elites, Wall Street, Walmart, corporate boards, the political elites in Washington. And just to give you an example of this, we had, and to go back to your example of the P4 lab, yesterday, Anthony Fauci, you know, the god of National Institutes of Health, actually, in a response to a question from Jake Tapper on CNN, refused to rule out categorically cooperation with China on biological research, which shows you that the good common sense of the American people is not shared where it at this point counts. Which are those people who make decisions regarding cooperation with China.
Lastly, Gordon, we have just released today at the Committee on the Present Danger, China's Captive Nations Coalition, a new report. I imagine you have not had a chance to look at it yet, but I'd be very interested in your take on its assessment of Xi Jinping's so-called Belt and Road Initiative as really an imperial effort to colonize and dominate the world by placing infrastructure and Chinese access to markets and to natural resources of various countries into a context that lends itself to, again, dominion over those nations, but also power projection from them, or at least some of them. And your take on all of that would be appreciated.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that Djibouti, which has more than 100% of its annual gross domestic product as a debt to China, is the location of China's first and so far only offshore military base. We also see two projects in the Bahamas, which are of extreme concern to us. And that is the project in Freeport, which is a container port, which is about 87 miles east of Palm Beach, and another project in the Bahamas in the Abaco Islands. these port projects appear to be economically unjustifiable, which means that we probably will see defaults to China, which means China probably will take them over as they took over the port at Hambantota in Sri Lanka, which means that these, like the port in Djibouti, could become a Chinese naval base. Djibouti is, you know, arguably on the other side of the world, but the Bahamas are within spitting distance of the American mainland. So these are things that we have got to look at. China is heavily invested in the Caribbean. It's heavily invested in Latin America. A series of American presidents did not seem to care about China's penetration of the Western Hemisphere. And we are going to be in a struggle with China, not in the South China Sea or East China Sea, but within the Gulf of Mexico and other places, which very, very close to the American homeland.
We may be experiencing them in the South China Sea as well. This is the problem, is that, as this report makes clear, it is a global phenomenon, and it is amazing, I guess is the right word for it, that the Chinese have gotten as far with this. Some 140 countries are now either already in the process of being enslaved as new captive nations of China, or are in the process of beginning to get into such arrangements, debt trap and otherwise. Gordon, I know you'll be following this. I hope everyone will check it out at captivenations.org. Gordon, thank you for your time today. As always, you are generous with it, and your insights into what China is up to and what it means for us are absolutely indispensable. And I look forward to visiting with you again next week on all of this and more. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll touch on some of this with Sam Faddis and the implications for our security here and abroad, as well as what the left is up to inside our country, the enemy within. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A new poll suggests that likely 2022 voters are primed for an even greater than normal course correction in a president's first off-year election. The Trafalgar Group, one of the country's most accurate pollsters, found stunning majorities hostile to a problem with which Joe Biden is inextricably associated, namely Chinese influence operations inside the United States. The poll found that 81% were concerned about China's influence over our government, media, and culture, with an actual majority very concerned. It seems inevitable that as the public learns more about Mr. Biden's own compromise by Chinese influence operators and that of so many of his administration's top officials, voters will rightly become even more alarmed. The question is, how much damage will the CCP be able to do before those opposed to its penetration and subversion here receive a powerful electoral mandate to reverse course? This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and it's time for our weekly visit with one of our other regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, the great Charles Sam Faddis, a former Army officer turned undercover Central Intelligence Agency clandestine officer, turned author, turned congressional candidate, and now a driving force behind an absolutely indispensable online resource, andmagazine.com. He's also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and an extraordinarily valuable contributor to our public policy debate about what the Chinese are up to, what it means for us, and more. And we're always delighted to have him with us. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I want to particularly pick up on a couple of things that we touched on with Gordon Chang in the previous segment, Sam, but to get your unique perspective on, if we can. Let's start with this poll from the Trafalgar Group that indicates tremendously large percentages of the American people are concerned about what the Chinese are doing in the way of exercising influence over our government, our media, and our culture. Does that surprise you, point one? And point two, what does it signal is needed in terms of an adjustment in our public policies towards the Chinese rather urgently?
You know, the poll numbers really did not surprise me. I have sort of infinite faith in the wisdom and the common sense of average Americans. And I think it is very clear that, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to Donald Trump personally. If we take him politically out of the equation and you talk issues, the overwhelming majority of Americans have for a long time recognized that we need a major course correction when it comes to China, that they're eating our lunch, and that this is not just about economics, not that that's not significant, but this is literally a battle for who's going to be the dominant power on the planet. And Americans obviously don't want a communist nation to be that. Of course, what's terrifying is that we have an administration now bought and paid for by the Chinese that doesn't really seem to care one whit about that. I mean, they are staffed at the uppermost levels with people who are completely co-opted by the Chinese. So like with so many Biden policies, we have a real disconnect between the direction they're going and the direction the majority of Americans want them to go.
Amen to that. You have been contributing to an important project, the Accountability Initiative, which has been documenting the extent to which what you've just described is taking place at the senior-most levels of the United States government, frankly, from President Biden himself on down. And Sam, when you look at the opportunities for such individuals to be subjected to Chinese influence operations, or simply in one form or another, induced to do China's bidding, it poses a real and present danger that the public seems alive to, but I'm not sure they fully understand the extent of it. How would you characterize the degree to which Chinese, well, espionage organizations or influence operations, the United Front Work Department or various other entities, can exploit the fact that they have, for example, in the person of Bill Burns, the CIA director, a man who has worked with them in the past? And is that something that you would expect, if those dots were actually connected with the American people, would translate into a profoundly powerful impetus for the kind of course correction we at the Committee on the Present Danger of China believe is needed?
Yeah, I think that, we're not talking about something speculative. We're talking about something that the Chinese have worked on for decades, essentially been at war with us in a covert fashion, a clandestine fashion for many years. They have now achieved astounding success, maybe a success greater than any nation has ever achieved in sort of penetrating and co-opting the elite of another nation. And they fully intend to exploit it. This is not just sort of a, hey, that's great, we got a bunch of guys in the Biden administration who like us. This was all done very deliberately, and absolutely they're going to exploit it. I had a conversation the other day with an old colleague who shall remain nameless, but was a senior CIA officer, now retired, and particularly worked in the counterintelligence realm. And he was reached out to me because he was so distraught because at what he was seeing. And we both agreed that once upon a time, a single mole at a senior level in the federal government would have been terrifying to us. If we were talking about a single Soviet spy anywhere near the U.S. cabinet, oh my God, that would be potentially we could lose a war that way. And we would have been hunting for that individual. And yet it's almost impossible to get to the end of the list of such individuals that are at a minimum co-opted by the communist Chinese. The American people really should be seized with that, because again, we could lose a war over this.
Or even in the absence of war, simply lose our country as a result of the cumulative effects of sort of penetration and subversion here at home. I'm reminded in this regard of a really important insight into one of the other ways in which this is manifesting itself, this penetration, if you will, namely Natalie Winters at the National Pulse, a terrific young investigative reporter, has brought to light early returns on some work she's been doing researching investments that members of Congress have been making in companies, in some cases tied directly to the People's Liberation Army, not just, of course, doing the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. Sam Faddis, again, from the perspective of someone who used to run influence or at least espionage operations on behalf of the United States. What does that kind of, well, interest, shall we say, give rise to in terms of access and the ability to influence or manipulate the target?
Well, at a minimum, of course, it pulls people into situations in which they can be pressured, in which they can be co-opted, or in which they decide that, you know, their interests are now more aligned with Beijing than they are with Washington, D.C. That, in that regard, I think a massive number of individuals, very important people in the United States, long since crossed that line. You know, they've gone for profit and for the almighty dollar over the American people. But it also, we should never lose track of the fact that all of this is often done very deliberately. And the ultimate goal of all of this is to literally recruit somebody to do the bidding of Beijing. You get pulled down. We used to refer in the trade to being pulled down a rabbit hole until all of a sudden you are in a completely different place and you literally are controlled by, well, whoever has recruited you. And that has most definitely, obviously, happened in situations. We look at what was going on with Eric Swalwell, and frankly, we don't know that he wasn't fully recruited by the Chinese. So as we're looking at these folks, we should not lose track of the fact that we're not just necessarily talking about people that have kind of lost the bubble and changed sides. We, in some of these cases, we are definitely looking at people who have been formally recruited and who function as agents for the other side. And that's not conspiracy theory. That's the way the game works. And since our counterintelligence apparatus doesn't seem to be doing anything much these days, apparently nobody's looking for them.
This is alarming in the extreme. But even if you stop short of saying, by virtue of having money invested in these companies, members of Congress may be co-opted to the point where they could be doing the bidding of the Chinese as essentially agents for China. You certainly are seeing, in this case, members of Congress, and frankly, for that matter, perhaps tens, if not hundreds of millions of Americans whose portfolios have Chinese investments in them, being at least subjected to pressure or having calculations about, their life savings, for example, being affected by possible difficulties with the Chinese Communist Party. And all of this portends, I'm afraid, a degree of subversion of our country that is really frightening. And why I take heart from the concerns that are now being expressed by many, many Americans on this score of Chinese influence in our country. And this brings me to another related topic, which you've covered, I think, and Sam Faddis, and that is this decision by the Biden Justice Department to drop its prosecution of five Chinese operatives who were inside academic institutions, I believe, using their access there to steal proprietary information and other secrets. What's up with this decision, as best you can tell, and what does it seem to portend for the policies of the Biden administration, compromised, as you say, as it is?
Well, all of the individuals in question are spies. I mean, they were charged technically with various forms of visa fraud, that kind of thing. But they were all individuals sent here by the Chinese to penetrate various institutions and obviously steal information and take it back to China. And this has been ongoing and rampant many, many, many years. What happened is that under Donald Trump, for the first time, maybe ever, we actually started to push back on this. And we started shutting things down, arresting people, throwing people out of the country, and really beginning to turn the corner on this and make a dent in a looting operation that's been ongoing for many years and frankly threatens to change the balance of power in the planet. Is way down that road, because with the one card that we have to play against the Chinese, is no longer our mass industrial base, but it is our command of high technology, of cutting edge technology. That's what we rely upon to win a war. That's why the Chinese are laser focused on stealing every secret we have in that regard to take away that advantage. That's precisely what these guys were part of, guys and gals were part of. And what it tells you is that the Biden administration, not surprisingly, given what we were just saying, is now reversing that policy. This is not an isolated event, and it won't be the last thing that they do. You are now going to see piece by piece them dismantle this policy and take us back to the days when the Chinese are allowed to just run amok. And I can tell you from a counterintelligence perspective, if you're going to let them operate this way with literally thousands, tens of thousands of people stealing everything that isn't nailed down, no counterintelligence service on earth can stop them. I mean, the first key is you have to take away their platforms and limit the number of individuals that are in this country. And then that's how you do this. You can't follow tens of thousands of people and read all their emails. That's impossible.
Well, and tens of thousands may be substantially smaller than the actual number of problems. They're estimated to be something like 300,000 Chinese students in this country. And all of them are here because the Chinese Communist Party selected them to be in this country and is able to assure their compliance with its dictates, either through, you know, the direct consent of the students, more often than not, probably that's the case, but certainly by applying pressure to their families still in China if they don't play ball. Sam, this brings me to a last point. I talked a little bit about it with Gordon Chang. We have just released today, our Committee on the Present Danger, China and its Captive Nations Coalition, a new report about the Belt and Road Initiative that China is using as part of the build-out of its colonial empire. You can read it for yourselves, folks, at captivenations.org. And Sam, I just wonder, if you were in the game, as you were in the past, and had the ability to have a large presence of your companies and your infrastructure build out and your efforts to penetrate governments enabled by this kind of project, I imagine that you would have found it a huge boon to the job that you used to do for the United States government. Unfortunately, this is now in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. Give us your professional assessment of what it might mean for the threat that party poses to the rest of us.
Right. Well, what it means is ultimately you're going to own the government. I mean, you're going to individually recruit as many people as you want because you're the big dog, because you've got money, because you've influence. And in addition to just formally recruiting people and sort of, you know, doing whatever you want, obviously from a national security perspective, since you're the big dog and you've got money and you've got influence, that's not just going to translate into stealing secrets. That's going to translate directly into steering policy and decisions. When you're all done, that government, and we have certainly done this historically in other parts of the world, when you're all done, country X does what you want them to do because you are connected to them and in control of them via so many different points of contact. That's ultimately, by the way, what this is all about. It is about dominating and controlling these countries and China's rise to become the preeminent power on the planet, politically, military, economically. And right now they're succeeding.
They are indeed. And the implications of it are quite staggering. Check out captivenations.org, folks, for China's dream, the world's nightmare. It's, as I said earlier, really required reading if you want to understand the kind of world we're in and what's coming at us from China. Sam Faddis, as always, thank you for your insights into all of this. I think it's important to note that while we've done this in the past ourselves to try to advance our interests, it's never been anything on this scale, and certainly not for the kinds of malevolent purposes that the Chinese are up to. But we will be continuing to track what's going on in this regard and appreciate your help in doing so much. Next up, we'll speak with Christian Watson, an impressive young man, about what is going on in terms of critical race theory and identity politics to divide our country, perhaps at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, among others as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we're joined for the first time by a young man I have only just come across. His name is Christian Watson. He is the host of a very interesting podcast he calls the Pensive Politics Podcast, and he has a YouTube channel, the Christian Watson channel. You will find his writings and appearances in a variety of platforms, including USA Today, Newsmax, BBC, Radio London, Washington Examiner, and more. And he is also the spokesperson for something called Color Us United. And maybe, Christian, I'd ask you to start by telling us a little bit about that. First of all, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. I'm happy to be here. And so Color Us United is basically a media campaign which is designed to do one thing. It's designed to basically tell Americans the truth about, you know, our country, and that is that not only as a country, but as a people, we are all colorfully united by our differences. So our identities, whether it's our race or whatever, do not define us as human beings. Our uniqueness defines us as human beings. And we're here to kind of fight against the tide of this intelligentsia, which has basically been trying to convince Americans that their differences, their race or whatever, makes them different or makes them oppressed or not oppressed or dominant or not dominant. We're rejecting that message and bringing a very different message to the American people.
Well, bless you for doing so. It certainly is indisputably needed at the moment. And I'm reminded of how needed by the recent performances of a number of athletes ostensibly representing our country at the Tokyo Olympics who have chosen to use opportunities afforded them to essentially revile our nation, whether it's taking knees or turning their back on the flag or what have you. They're not alone in doing this, of course, but it's a particularly vivid example of the problem that I think your Color Us United effort is trying to counter. And I guess I'd ask you, Christian, to the extent that you have been thoughtfully, if I can use that expression, pensively thinking about these things and addressing them in various ways, to what extent is this a product not simply of what's been taught in our schools of late or the sort of larger New Left movement that it spawned, I think was spawned by, but really the hostility of foreign powers, including notably communist China, to use sort of Maoist race warfare techniques to try to weaken our country. In other words, are we seeing not just this problem from sort of enemies within, but enemies without as well?
Yeah, so I think a few things. I think as it relates to the knee thing, that although there are a lot of Americans who are convinced, who are sincerely convinced that the problems of America are reflected in our symbolism. And regardless of what one thinks of American symbolism, one thing is clear, and this is, should not be a controversial opinion, a symbol simply represents an idea. It does not represent a certain kind of, or at least in the terms of the flag itself, I'll speak for the flag, not any other symbol, the flag itself represents an idea. It does not represent any particular point in history. Yet I think when folks do take the knee, they kind of conflate the flag with a certain point in history that they may think is undesirable. And that's kind of, you know, missing the forest for only the trees. And so, but there is a industry in the woke movement that is pushing this kind of stuff, and they are, you know, encouraging this kind of dissent. And look, we are Americans. Dissent is a part of our DNA. But I think that rational dissent is much more powerful than simply emotionally driven dissent. And so I can't speak to what China is doing. I've heard things, but I really can't speak to it authoritatively. But I can speak to what people like Kaepernick or the Olympic athletes a few days have done. And I think that it is really a misguided attempt to address particular issues by besmirching universal principles, and that will always get you off the mark, in my opinion.
You have spoken out against this so-called critical race theory doctrine and indoctrination, Christian, and I'm interested as to, as a young black, thoughtful, articulate spokesman for this initiative that is trying to bring us together, how would you characterize this, I think of it as hate America agenda, as a phenomenon inside, both communities of color and more broadly? Is it anything other than, designed to divide and undermine our country?
Before I get into critical race theory, I think the term communities of color legitimizes these kind of approaches. I think that's it can be somewhat dangerous, because I think of a community. I don't think of a community of a particular race. I think of a community of individuals who are united by their unique differences, a community of people who are hardworking and simply want to make a good living for their kids and make an impact in the world in some way. I think that's what a lot of Americans at least want to do. That's in our DNA. But what the critical race theorists would say is it would say, no, these are communities of color. These are communities of black people or white people, and they have been impacted by X, Y, and Z, and therefore they're suffering from X, Y, and Z, and you cannot convince me otherwise. So critical race theory is basically, I call it, an academic rhetorical device, which likes to view American institutions through the lens of racism. It likes to view certain statistical facts and disparities through the lens of racism, and then uses those two things to advance certain policy prescriptions. And really, it was started as a legal tradition in the late 70s, early 80s by Kimberly Crenshaw and her compadres. And it was basically an attempt to pick up where they believe the civil rights movement just didn't really fulfill its purpose. The critical race theorists believe the civil rights movement was too, quote unquote, colorblind and assimilationist, and that overlooked, in their opinion, some glaring spots where black Americans were still getting a bad hand. The problem with critical race theory is that it redefines racism. It views black Americans as entirely oppressed, and it views white Americans and even the idea of quote-unquote whiteness as inherently evil. It has no respect for Americans' founding traditions or our institutions, and yet it wants to use our institutions for ends that they were not meant for, and that itself is malevolent. So there are just a lot of things about critical race theory that are really concerning, and should the hairs on all of our heads should stand up whenever we hear people talk about American history that way.
You've written a very thoughtful piece the other day at the Washington Examiner entitled, "Without Inequity, Diversity is Impossible." Talk a little bit about this idea of equity and how it and sort of its companions, diversity and inclusion, are now being used, to essentially, again, fracture our country and achieve outcomes that will almost certainly be highly detrimental to, again, as you say, individuals as well as the nation as a whole.
Absolutely. So the idea of equity, at least as it's posed by people on the left, is that there are certain groups, and it's very important to get this phrase, there's certain groups in this country that have had a worse or bad hand historically than other groups, and that may reflect in those groups' standing in society currently. Therefore, an equitable approach will be to give those groups a hand up, to give those groups the resources that they would need to succeed, where other groups who've already had those resources have already succeeded, or at least this is what they think. Now, of course, the problem with this approach is that it's very generalizistic. There are plenty of white folks who are wealthy. There are also plenty of white folks who are dirt poor, go to Appalachia. I'm not entirely sure that the equity people would be going to Appalachia looking at the white folks and saying, you're oppressed, because, again, that doesn't fit their narrative. There are plenty of black folks who are rich. There are plenty of black folks who are middle class. All our circumstances in life and our problems in life are, I think, defined by our own individual journeys in life, not by some mythical group membership that we're supposed to have off the basis of an incredibly arbitrary. So I think the idea of equity falls right there. It's not really applicable. I cannot account, Frank, for groups. I cannot account for those sort of abstract concepts. I can only account for my neighbor, my neighbor's neighbor, my family and my friends. And that's where we live. If you live in observable, empirical reality, that's where you live. Equity is just a sort of egalitarian concept. It doesn't take into account the very real bare bones facts of reality. But the problem is, when you have a concept like that that is put into reality, destruction is bound to happen. Chaos is bound to happen. This is what Vogelin warned against, eminentizing the eschaton. I think Buckley also put it that way. You know, trying to bring heaven upon earth. That is precisely what these people are trying to do. They're trying to explain all differences by calling them injustices and then roll them away with the wand, when in all reality, that would just cause a lot of destruction.
This, again, sounds to me very much like, you know, sort of Marxist utopianism. To assure that there are equal outcomes, not equal opportunities, the antithesis, really, of American individualism and self-reliance and the opportunities that are afforded to all of us to make the most of our lives by hard work and, dedicating ourselves, hopefully, to, you know, the betterment of our society, but certainly in the process, assuring our own fulfillment. When you look at this kind of agenda, Christian, it clearly has at its core this sense of grievance, promotion and harnessing for political ends, does it not? And how, you know, would you recommend we respond to what is clearly still an ascendant force in American politics, this idea that identity politics uber alles?
Yeah. I do believe that there is a very powerful political force in this country that utilizes grievance, utilizes the emotional energy of a lot of people, particularly a lot of minorities, for certain political purposes. Now, with that being said, do I think that the people who are doing this are doing it because they do not believe it? No, I think that there are folks in this country that actually believe in not everything they're saying. I think it's the people in the upper echelon who are pushing through these theories in academia who actually believe that they are true. There's nothing worse, and I like to say this a lot, there's nothing worse than a fool who thinks he's not a fool. There's nothing worse than someone who is willfully ignorant and is completely oblivious that he is willfully ignorant. So I think that's what's going on with academia. I think people like Abramex Kendi and Rama D'Angelo, some of the thought leaders of this new kind of movement, of this push for equity among other things, actually do believe this. I think that people who kind of predate them, like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, have also been sort of harbingers for this kind of thing as well. And so the question is, how do we fight back against it? You fight back against it by understanding what the first principles of this country are predicated upon. We fight back by understanding that America is not just an abstract concept that exists somewhere in the ideas realm or whatever. No, America's ideas are good because they are real, because they are material, because they are tangible, and because they allow human beings to be as free as possible within the proper moral and ethical constraints. And when you have that very concrete real idea that we can all live out every day without going to some classroom, without, you know, trying to rationalize some formula or whatever, to have those really ideas that are real and tangible is to have an advantage against ideas like this equity stuff, like this anti-racism stuff, that are rather distant prospects of a kind of society that people want to create. So I say stick to what's real. Stick to what our founders understood what's real. Stick to what, you know, generations of Americans understood what's real. And embody that spirit by, you know, not allowing our traditions to be ruthlessly deconstructed in the name of their equal. We have to reject that. We have to acknowledge that America is a good country, even though we've had mistakes. And we have to have a more, I would say, enlightenment-based approach to conversations around race and equity that do not involve attacking anyone or redefining racism, but involve talking to people about their individual experiences with racism that they've had and how we can move past this kind of mindset in society. That's how we beat this stuff.
The two questions that occur, and just very quickly, if you would, the idea of reparations being imposed and equity preferences, as I believe they're now being called. What are your thoughts on those two hot-button issues? question.
Yeah, reparations. Yeah, reparations is the idea that justice can be dispensed even if people who the justice would be dispensed against are not alive anymore. And I think that's just a very warped idea of justice. Justice is not about giving people things equally, which is what social justice people think it's about. Justice is about, very simply, this will sound very simple and intuitive, but it's lost on many people, protecting someone's rights. There is no one whose rights is being violated today by the fact that slavery occurred many, many years ago. So just from that very simple viewpoint, but that very succinct viewpoint, reparations is unnecessary. Ethical preferences. Yeah, so this is what happens when you have a mindset that says certain groups, not individuals, but certain groups are at a disadvantage. You will take folks from those groups, so affirmative action did, and you will give them preferential treatment, typically the detriment of other people who may have been more, have more qualifications or what have you. This is what happened with the Harvard case, with the Asians and everything. And I think that, again, representative of a mind that cannot conceptualize differences beyond injustice. So we have to first understand a proper principle of what justice is, and then get rid of the false ones, and then be willing to accept that differences are okay. Not everyone performs at the same level. We are all, as human beings, still equal in our freedom and our value, and that's what matters. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, and thank you for succinctly describing them. Very quickly, how do you find more out about Color Us United? Where should people go for details?
Absolutely. So just go to colorusunited.org. You can follow us on all of our social media. Just type in Color Us United on your favorite platform. And you can find us there. You can send an email to me or email to anyone else on our staff. You can donate to us. You can sign up for our list, our mailing list. And, you know, I'm just very happy I was able to come on and talk to you, Frank.
It's been our pleasure. I hope you'll come back soon. Christian Watson of Pensive Politics and also Color Us United. Oh, it's been a delight to get your thoughts on all of these hot button issues, as I say, and what we should be doing about them. And as I say, I'd love to visit with you about this further in the future. Thank you for time today. I hope we'll be talking with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.